Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, where we discuss the topics of the day. Now, normally, I'm Adam Lowther, I am always and will always be me, but I'm normally joined by Jim Petrosky and Curtis McGiffin, but they're on assignment this week. They were down at Barksdale Air Force Base teaching, and so they weren't able to join me on the show as normal. But of course, I asked Alex, you know, Alex Littlefield, whom has been on the show a few times. I said, hey, what would be a great topic? And he said, well, let's talk China. And then, of course, he said, well, you know, Feiling Wang would be a great person to have on. He's a professor and he's written some great books. How many books do you have, Feiling, on China? Five or six?
Quite a few.
And so we asked him to join us, and we thought the three of us could discuss some of the current events going on in China. And now, of course, sort of the latest news that I read about it a little bit and sort of left it to sit back and just wait to see how it matured. And that is the news that Xi Jinping has had a stroke or may have terminal illness. We've seen this with Putin, where people said, Putin's dying, he's got cancer. And then, I thought, is this the same kind of thing, or is she actually ill? So I thought you guys who follow, the media in China, do you have any better idea of what the actual ground truth is?
I think Alex may have some inside channel of information. I don't know. But based on what I have seen, especially in the overseas Chinese social media platform, overseas Chinese media social media platforms like X and WeChat and so on, there has been a rumor keep coming back about she is terminally ill or is already in the hospital or disabled, had a stroke or some unknown big diseases. And there have been almost a cottage of theory talking about how the Chinese official news media is faking his appearances. For example, she showed up meeting some foreign dignitaries, and quite a few people said, well, that's just a fake, because look at his hand, look at the ears, and so on. It's not him. It's a body double or something. It has been coming back again and again. Some reputable web personalities have been also spreading this. So I don't know, maybe Alex can know for sure. You may have already talked to Xi like last night. We don't know. But in my opinion, this actually is quite interesting, not because it's accurate or not, but because it suggests the mindset of many Chinese, especially the Chinese online. They basically are wishing Xi to have trouble, to die, right? It also suggests that the Chinese political system is quite fragile in a way that it seems to be everything is pinned on one person, right? A 70-year-old, kind of a little bit overweight kind of person who is not known for being athletic. And then, people say, well, if he's gone, then everything will be fine. It will be very different. So that suggests kind of fragility over there.
So what you're saying is that when a great power has an elderly, sickly national leader, that could be a problem, huh? I wonder if there's any other countries in the world that might be in a similar position. I'm not sure, but none come to mind.
Well, many years ago, none come to mind, except for our current president, who is rumored to have some dementia, but he's leaving, so it's kind of good. Many years ago, there actually was a book written by a French scholar talking about sick men in charge and documenting all those sick national leaders they drag on. including actually U.S. presidents like Woodrow Wilson and FDR, right? Quite a few.
Yeah.
And of course, Russian leaders, and many of them, Soviet leaders, many of them.
And drop off, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. From Mao Zedong and downwards. So it would not be a big shock if indeed Xi Jinping is seriously sick or even disabled. It's not being a big shock. But to me, the same kind of fragility, same kind of personal kind of weight the Chinese political system is still having in the 21st century, that's really remarkable. And that suggests that we, the Americans, ought to pay more attention to what China is really up to, because they got a lot of money, a lot of weapons. And on this kind of system, with that kind of hope pinned so much on a sick old man, a senior citizen, that's bad news, in my opinion. It's a recipe for disaster.
Well, let me turn to you, Alex. And so let's suppose hypothetically, this is a hypothetical. Let's suppose that all of the stories are true. And she, in fact, is, let's say he's had a stroke or there's something else. And let's suppose he dies. What would the death of Xi mean for both China and for Taiwan? Would the Taiwanese be, standing in the streets and celebrating, or would they be fearful of what might come next? So what would it mean for both China and for Taiwan? I'll take your take first, Alex, and then we'll turn to you, Failing.
Maybe I'm the contrarian here, but I tend to think that who's in power tends to be overrated, because these people, whether it's Trump or Biden or Xi or someone else, they are as powerful as they might seem, and being on top of the pyramid, they are still on a pyramid. And that pyramid, there's a big substructure that supports who they are. So if she's gone, there'll be someone else to take his place. And whoever it is, they'll most likely, the big question is it going to still be someone within the Communist Party, right? And there's no reason it shouldn't be. So the party will continue. They'll just find a new person to fill in his shoes. And Taiwan, the status between mainland China and Taiwan won't change in any way. It'll still be seen as an integral part of mainland China. So while on one hand we think, okay, good, this means happy days are here again, now that if she's gone, but I don't see that it's going to really make a whole lot of difference in terms of, say, the challenge, this pacing challenge that China has been for the United States. What might be a bigger issue for China is its economy. So whether the economy can survive as it is. So regardless of who's in power now, she or someone else are going to have to deal with the structural problems within China's economy and China's demographics. So that's probably a bigger elephant in the room than Xi's health at the moment.
So then the deep state still runs China, just like it's supposed to run the United States. Yeah. So I guess we're more similar than we thought. So yeah. Failing, what's your take? Go ahead, Alex.
Go ahead.
Briefly,
go ahead,
at least Alex. The deep state in China, you know who they are, and they exist and they have a name. In the U.S., you don't quite know who they are. They are invisible. So in that sense, it's probably more comfortable living under the Chinese Communist Party.
Alex, I have to say, I tend to agree with you almost 99% of the time, except for gambling tips. I'm not a good gambler, so you're not a good gambler either. So, because we spend time in Macau together, you know, that's kind of a fun time. But anyway, but on this one, I would have to voice a little disagreement, because the Chinese system is actually quite different from the United States. I spent pages and pages in my book writing about differences between the two systems. I call them structurally incompatible and genetically incompatible or whatever, right? The deep state, using Adam's words, are existing in both countries for sure. But the Chinese deep state is much less entrenched as the United States, for good or for bad, right? In the United States, you could say we have a deep state that is much solid, much stable than the one in China, which is for good or bad. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. You know that, right? So in the case of China, that kind of system, when a leader is suddenly changed by disease, by nature, or even by assassination, right? As a recent study showed, that different countries, when their leader is taken out in the 20th century, in the 20th century until today, the impact on policy difference is very different. It has a lot to do with how the deep state is constructed, right? If it's a democracy, it tends to be the influence is small, actually correct, right? In non-democracy, the impact of successful assassination, according to scholars, is very big. Sometimes can be very dramatic, right? Simply because in that kind of system, much is rested on the top leader's personal wish and personal ability, right? If there was no Hugo Chavez, Venezuela could be very different today than it is, right? That's the kind of idea, right? Same thing about the Lenin, Stalin, Mao, and now Xi Jinping, right? Or Putin in Russia, for example, right? So I would submit for you guys to think about this. In an authoritarian, non-democratic, non-open society, the deep state is powerful for sure, but it's much fragile. And the ultimate decision made in a deep state is very much rest in the hands of one person, or to a great degree. Say, the U.S. president, mighty, powerful, you know, glorious as he or she may be, the U.S. president can only control the budget the Congress allows him to have, right? And maybe making some decisive different decisions in foreign policy. But beyond that, how much can you do? Very little. You want to drain the swamp? Well, the swamp is actually going to swallow you, right? It's very hard. So in the case of China, the top leader can do a lot. Just like the United States president can do in foreign policy, the Chinese president can do roughly the same in domestic policy as well. So that gives that position extraordinary importance. So if Xi Jinping indeed is disabled or incapacitated or worse, then we should anticipate some big change. But in the long run, I think Alex is still right. The Communist Party system is such, that's the point I've been trying to hang out in my work, is the Communist Party is still such, the big range is still there, right? So they may swing here and there. So between Deng Xiaoping and Mao Zedong and Xi Jinping, quite big difference, right? But the fundamentals will be there. China will challenge the United States, and China will be structurally, genetically incompatible with the United States for many times to come until the Chinese deep state is transformed. And that's going to be hard.
So we saw some political news here in the U.S. You know, we saw President Biden decided that he's going to withdraw from, you know, the reelection, and he's stepping aside. And, it appears that all of the support has gotten behind Vice President Kamala Harris. And I'm curious from you two guys, what is your take on what are the Chinese, what are Xi and you know, the Central Committee and the senior leadership of China, as they're looking at this U.S. I mean, we've had an assassination attempt on Donald Trump. I mean, it's been a really interesting election so far. There's a lot that's happened. And what do you think that they're, and this sort of, you know, it goes back to this point, as I've talked to mostly American allies over the years, it's, hey, we need to know who your president's going to be and what they think, because your foreign policy vacillates from administration to administration. So for the Chinese who are watching this election, I can only imagine what they're thinking and maybe what are they hoping will happen. Can y'all give me some insights? You know, what are the Chinese thinking and what are they hoping will happen? How about you, Alex?
Maybe a quick anecdote. When I was when Trump became president the first time around, I was actually teaching at the University of Nottingham in China. So I was in the Chinese time zone, and I don't allow my students to be on the phones or social media, but they still find ways around it. So in the middle of a lecture, one of the students just finally got really excited and was like ecstatic. And I said, what's going on? Why the sudden excitement? And it turns out a couple of the students in the room were where Donald Trump had just won the election. So I had apparently had students in China. These were Chinese students in China who were very supportive and excited about Trump's election because they would have seen him as a challenger to the Communist Party and to Xi Jinping. This was in whenever that was that a 2017? I'm losing track of time. Or 2015? Yeah.
2016.
Somewhere in there, yeah, in that time frame. So she was still relatively new at the time in 2016, but I could tell already that things, the pot was getting hotter day by day, like things were getting tightening down. I would tease a friend of mine, like China's becoming more and more like North Korea every day, and it would upset that friend. But I could see under Xi, China was becoming more like a North Korea type country. So there are a lot of fans or supporters of Trump because they see him as someone who's actually going to stand up and challenge China. But in terms of foreign policy and all, there's still some limitations because you're limited, like on the U.S. side, you're limited by budgets. You're limited by, you have something like, for example, the Department of State. That's not really going to change no matter who's president. The Department of State is kind of like represents when you're referring to the deep state. You know, there's these things, these institutions, these organizations, these cultures that regardless of who is president, they are going to stay the way they are. And that's true of most of the administrative state in this town. But backtracking just a little bit quickly to like Xi Jinping, if he's in power, not in power, with regards to Taiwan, there would be no change. But then his pet projects like the Idai Lu, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative, those may fall, those kind of rest or fall based on his personality because these are programs that he's really pushing and supporting. So there will be individual programs that may or may not survive depending upon if he's in power or not. And then going to Trump, you know, it might be okay. What's the status with NATO? Is he withdrawing from NATO or this or that? So, but things tend to be not quite as black and white, right? Because he was just basically asking them to pony up. So whether it's Trump or not Trump, if it's Kamala Harris, I suppose we'll have a slightly more dovish foreign policy under Kamala Harris, a slightly more hawkish one under Trump. But Republicans can't really always get through what they want because they're more or less dealing with a Democratic administrative state in the city. So in that sense, if a Democratic president might actually get to push through more of what they want rather than, say, if Trump is president.
Yeah. Failing.
Yeah, I agree with a lot Alex has just said. I think the Chinese are viewing this election with a slightly different perspective from many of Americans. For example, some well-known Chinese analysts have openly said in Chinese and English that they prefer Donald Trump over Joe Biden and now, of course, Kamala Harris for the very simple reason. The reason actually to me is quite a classic realist analysis. That is, they consider Trump to be, quote, more harmful to the United States than to China. That's basically their calculation, which actually I have to give them credit. So for being, hey, this is a kind of a reasonable, kind of cool-headed analysis, right? Maybe they are wrong. Maybe Donald Trump is not more harmful to the United States. Maybe they're right. But that's the calculation. That calculation, I think, I don't have, of course, the kind of access Alex has. I don't know whether Xi Jinping is really taking this kind of advice. But I can see from their actions or official, unofficial words published in Chinese media, by papers, individual chats, and so on, they do prefer Donald Trump over Joe Biden or now Harris, right? You can see very subtle but very obvious kind of preferences. They said, you know, why Harris is so bad to Americans, right? Or why Donald Trump is good for America, which is not kind of interesting for them to say that. In other words, and also there are rumors, unsubstantiated, at least for me, that the Chinese government or some Chinese friends and agents are actually spending money doing real things, try to help out with the Republican ticket, right? Which, of course, I don't know. I'm not an FBI, so I don't know who's doing what. But it could be. But my conviction is the Chinese have their own view about preferring the preference of Donald Trump to be president. Interesting enough, as Alex mentioned, quite a few Chinese in the PRC or outside the PRC, they also like Donald Trump for a very different reason. They are not talking about Donald Trump being more harmful to China or to United States. They are thinking, quote, I'm paraphrasing this, so for my Republican friends, don't tell me personally. they are saying it takes a hooligan to fight a hooligan. They think Democrats are kind of too gentlemanlike, but Donald Trump can talk, can act like a hooligan.
He's right? A tough man.
He's a tough man. It takes a hooligan to fight a hooligan like Xi Jinping, right? So interesting enough, many anti-CCP people, anti-Xi Jinping people, actually prefer Trump because they think Trump can get things done, can make CCP suffer more. Two different kind of analysis, two different kind of rationale, but they all seem to prefer Donald Trump. So that seems to be suggesting that at least in Chinese social media and also official media, in a disguised way, you see a strong Chinese preference for Trump over, say, Democratic ticket.
Well, so then let me ask you guys. So it's interesting that, you know, the CCP wants him because they think he's bad for America. And then those who don't like the CCP want him because they think he'll challenge the CCP. So clearly one of them's wrong. They can't both, you know, we can both be wrong, but we can't both be right.
So Adam, I think I quickly, another one. I think they can be both right. You know, in the sense that Donald Trump may indeed harm America more than harm China, but Donald Trump's gesture and talks, right? And because he uses nasty words sometimes, right? Like the China virus and stuff like that, can be hurtful to CCP, to their standing. So it actually can be both, I think.
Yeah. So what's your take then, Alex? Is the CCP right about Trump, or the anti-CCP folks right about Trump? Or they both right? I mean, Feiling sort of took a middle ground position, but what's your take on it?
Yeah, it was interesting when Feiling mentioned the supporters of Trump within China. There was two sides to the coin. One, they thought he would be a better challenger to Xi and the Communist Party. And two, they were concerned that maybe Kamala Harris might actually be bad for the United States. And I remember, like a long time ago, similar debate in Taiwan over Chen Shui-bian. Because he had his supporters and his fans, they thought, well, he's making, you know, Taiwan more independent, making him stronger. But people who didn't like Chen Shui-bian would say, actually, he's done more damage to Taiwan than any spy from China could possibly do, because he was a very corrupt leader. He stole a lot of money from Taiwan government. You know, he'd end up in jail. So he was, on one hand, say the nationalistic Taiwanese really supported this man, but he was doing a lot to hurt the country. So it kind of depends on, to use that example, if you were, let's say you were a hardliner in China, on the surface, you wouldn't like Chen Shui-bian, right? Because he's advocating for Taiwan's independence. But then you're like, well, actually, he's actually a good guy because he's making the country weaker. He's causing a lot of division and problems. So it's one of those things like, there's not really a right or wrong. It's just kind of your perspective and how you look at it. Would Kamala Harris make the United States weaker than Trump? Then if you like this country, then you wouldn't want her. If you dislike the United States, then you would want her. But the reverse is true too, right? It just kind of depends. So it's a hard one to answer, which is why you just can't take the individuals in isolation too, because they're just part of these much bigger systems and structures, and they're in some ways kind of limited in what they can do. We're probably, anyway, we want to revisit that. But Trump, you saw, he was here for 4 years, and a lot of things he wanted to do, he said he would do, he couldn't get done, right? Building the wall, he couldn't get it done. And that was his main platform. Because it wasn't because he didn't have the nerve or he was unable to, like, on an individual level, but he has to work with people, and working with people in institutions, they're the ones who can slow down and prevent you from getting done what you want to get done.
Well, then let me posit a sort of a follow-on, and that is, you know, there's been a lot of discussion lately over, you know, the commentators talking about what does China want? What, you know, sort of what's the China end game? You know, is it Michael Pillsbury's 100-year marathon? Is it, you know, less malign than that? Is it, you know, there was a foreign affairs article. There's been one or two that sort of said, hey, listen, China really isn't the enemy of the United States. They think that America's aggressive and they're fearful. So let me posit an idea to you. And that is this idea that China is actively seeking to overthrow the American-led international order that was established after 1945. And to me, it seems pretty clear that that's taking place, that isn't, you know, Russia would like to see that happen. China, which has benefited from it greatly, but they still want to see it happen. You know, that the autocracies of the world would like to see this American-led order go away. Is that an accurate statement, or is that sort of hyperbole?
May I jump in? Oh, I think, sure. Adam, that to me, that's a very accurate statement of what I also think. I agree with you almost every bit of what you just said. So I will now leave to Alex to see whether he disagrees with you or not.
Yeah, so that's, and it kind of ties in well with the question of the health of Xi, because China, this, what was once called the Beijing Consensus, and it's whatever you want to call it, this kind of China taking first doing two steps. One is breaking down the current world order, so coming into the WTO and basically making it a completely useless organization. And then now, like, okay, we've just broken down the Western system that was built by the Americans and the West in general. We're now that is broken, let's try and provide an alternative. And with Xi in or out of the picture, this has been going on for a long time. And so I don't see why that would suddenly reverse course or stop. So I think there's still probably enough people in power in China who would still like to see a Beijing consensus, a Beijing order, however form it takes, replace the United States. And then, of course, there's other countries that would support China in that, because they see the U.S. as a threat. So of course, the North Koreans, the Russians, the Iranians, they would be very happy to see the United States as not the policeman of the world, and being able to, like, stop people's bank accounts and make life difficult. So they would rather, you know, the bad guys would like to see the bad guys in control and not the good guys in control. And one thing, I know this isn't about Feiling's recent book, but he mentioned one of the lines in his book, right? Hollywood movies, the good guy always wins. But in reality, it's not necessarily the good guy's going to win.
That's right.
And we have to be aware of that. There's no reason to expect that we will win. So anyhow, we need to be aware of this risk that we're facing.
Just to add a little bit to that, Alex, by my reading of history, not only good guys don't always win, actually, good guys lose most of the time. It's actually bad guys win the most of the time. As they say, you know, a bad boy gets the girl. Usually that's the case. I'm just sorry, you know, or a bad girl gets the boy, whatever. You know, if we play by the rules, your chance of winning actually is not that great. That's precisely why, as I wrote in my new book, that's precisely why Hollywood keeps producing those happy ending stories. Because in reality, in the real life, we don't have too many happy endings. We have actually sad endings more often. That's why Hollywood say, all right, let me give you some story, sort of soothing you, right? Make you feel better, to sell little tickets. And that's why.
It's funny that you bring that up. I've got a lot of sort of libertarian friends who, you know, want to make government small and get it out of people's lives. And I'll tell them that they're never going to achieve, they're never going to become the dominant ideology or group in the country, because they're not willing to use violence against anyone. And if you're not willing to organize for the use of violence, you're never going to control power. I mean, that's sort of the whole point of, you know. So it's funny to talk about this, and you know saying that the bad guys usually win. I mean, if we look at, you know, the collapse of Tsarist Russia and then the rise of the Soviet Union and the rise of, you know, when the CCP defeated, you know, the nationalists, there's a lot of history of bad guys winning. So, you know, that's why, you know, in some respects, That's why it's sort of really important that the American-led international order succeeds and remains, right, and that the United States is actually a successful country, because if there's no United States, what's the beacon of hope? You know, what's Ronald Reagan, you know, in his farewell address, he said, you know, America is a new Jerusalem, a shining city upon a hill. And his whole analogy was that it's a beacon of freedom to the world. And sort of if China or Russia or North Korea, they're all successful, and America sort of becomes a, you know, Western hemisphere power and not a global power, then who is that beacon of freedom? You know, and there isn't one.
Oh, maybe so, Canada. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. Well, I think isn't Justin Trudeau about to get the Canadians kicked out of NATO because they've refused to spend any money on defense? I got a few Canadian friends, and they're posting about it on LinkedIn and stuff. So I think that's a big deal in Canada right now. So, at any rate, how about final thoughts from you two guys? Because we're about out of time. So as we think about, you know, elections, Xi's health, toppling the American-led international order, I mean, it sort of be three big topics. I mean, any sort of takeaway thoughts from you guys?
Probably in the vein of the last conversation about the good guys and the bad guys, and to update the expression, now the bad girl gets the boy. There is a quote I'm going to take from Failing's book. It's pretty insightful. It says, "Evil knows of the good, but good does not know of the evil." And the Americans for just way too long have been extremely naive. And this goes way back in history. I mean, you can take it. I'm sorry, I'm from UVA, but Woodrow Wilson, League of Nations, not a good idea. Everything that that Roosevelt had to get up to get Stalin to join the new United Nations. He basically traded Eastern Europe so that Stalin could join the United Nations. These are cases of good not being aware of evil. These guys are like very innocent and very like naive dealing with these leaders who are very ruthless. And there's one person who gave a very good solution to this in terms of being balanced, being able to have your foot on both sides. It was to be innocent as a dove, but to be as wise as a snake. Be innocent as a dove and be wise as a serpent. We need to be innocent, have hands clean, but we know how to think the way that our adversaries think, so that we're prepared to be one step ahead of them and not always behind them, and like, hey, how did this happen? How did that happen? Oh, I didn't know this. Like, what's going on here? So not to be so naive.
I fully agree. I fully agree with what Alex just has said. And also, I really appreciate you quoted from my new book. But I have to correct that. The credit should go to Kafka, the very famous novelist, who actually coined that phrase. But I use that. But basically, I used a couple of pages to elaborate that point. The point is well taken. That is, yes, the United States is the only country, in my humble opinion, in the world that has both the power and internal setup to be the defender of the current world order that has benefited most countries, including China, right? Other than the United States, there's no other country can even come close to do that. So the Americans must sort of be not only just confident, but also feeling glad that we are guiding this whole thing. In doing so, we pay some price, but overall, I think it's a good deal. Americans actually benefit from that as well. So with that, I will actually say that it's great time again for the Americans to do the great thing. And I'm fully confident the United States can do it really well.
Yeah, I agree with you. So Alex, Failing, thanks for stepping in today and joining the discussion. I appreciate y'all doing that.
Oh, it was a great fun. Thank you.
And of course, thanks to you, the listeners. And, you know, if you haven't checked out thinkdeterrence.com, that's the NIDS website. It's a brand new website. Greg Sharp and Jim Petrosky spent a month or so rebuilding the website. So go check it out. There's a lot of good stuff up. If you haven't been to, you know, one of Alex's jobs is he sets up and hosts online events, and Failing spoke at one. And so look on our website for upcoming events and join them. You know, we they're open to the public, and we bring in a lot of great speakers. You know, Curtis is out there tweeting every day, and he's posting new and interesting articles on X. And of course, we've got lots of podcasts. We've got the NIDS View. We've got Deterrence Down Under, Real Space Strategy. And of course, you know, NucleCast, if you want to interview with you know, one of the sort of the top minds, go listen to a NucleCast episode. So, of course, there's lots out there. Come check us out at thinkdeterrence.com. And of course, I want to remind you to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.